We get on the telephone and welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, hey.
How's the weather in the Boston area? Is it any better than here, where we're back to the old familiar depressing rain and grayness?
Depressing is a matter of one's personal viewpoint, right? As a nautical fellow, I rather like a nice, foggy, raw, crisp, drizzly day like this. And it matches both the tenor of my life and my mood, so it works out well for me.
Well, you would embrace this, then, the way it is around here today. Well, we want to talk movies, and we've had a couple of great discussions the last 2 weeks on films. This time around, we're not looking at a specific year, but a genre, one that is perhaps underappreciated. So I begin by asking you this. Who decided out there that science fiction films, or science fiction in general, doesn't qualify as art?
It's not just science fiction, although you will see a lot of apologies almost made by some people who do write science fiction or make science fiction films. You get this also with horror, and you get this with comedy. And I don't know why, because there is no reason to think that Buster Keaton, for instance, isn't as good as Beethoven, or some of these films that we're going to discuss can't hold their own next to a Rear Window or The Searchers or Citizen Kane even. But you see it with Oscars. For instance, if you are winning Oscars for your film is probably lousy. If you go back through the history of something like the Oscars, they are given out to the most formulaic, anemic, lifeless, middle of the road. It's like film version of Muzak that is out there. And things that last, things that are firebrandy works of art, are not awarded. And you see it in something like publishing right now, where it's just the dross and the dreck and the safe and the boring, the placebo work that gets handed basically these fake laurels. So I don't know why that is befallen science fiction. There's a certain degree of snobbery, which is really weird with science fiction, because in science fiction, we have a mashup of a lot of different worlds, planets, if you will, coming together, where you have terror, you have suspense, you can have noir aspects, you can have futurism, you can have a kind of primitive nature to what's going on, where science fiction can be something that happens 5,000 years ago. Star Wars, in the galaxy far, far away, a long time ago, all of that. So I think it's really just elitism and snobbery that has put science fiction in this category, this limited category that it doesn't belong in at all.
Well, let's start by talking about a classic from 1951, The Thing from Another World, best known as The Thing, a great movie from a director who apparently, for whatever reason, did not want to be known as the director of this film. Why was that?
You referencing Howard Hawks there, and I think he is the director of this film as well, although, like you said, he's not billed as Christian Nyby, who is Hawks' longtime editor. And I think Hawks might have been doing his loyal longtime editor a favor by helping him with the director credit. It is clearly Hawks' picture, though, and I don't feel that he wanted to disavow himself from science fiction, and in many ways, it's kind of like the science fiction version of a Hawksian Western. Very Rio Bravo, where you have a circumscribed environment, instead of a jailhouse, it's an exploration outpost up on, the North Pole. And you have these men who are increasingly paranoid over this discovery that they have made. The ship has crashed, and they've tried to get out its occupants, and they've mistakenly blown up the ship, and there's this plant-like creature. It's basically a kale version of a vampire in the form of James Arneff romping around before he's Marshall Dillon in Dodge. And really, though, the monster in the film is paranoia. The paranoia of these men in this very controlled, compact environment, which I read almost as some sort of precursor of what you're going to get with the internet age. If they think this about me, I better go on the attack here. And everyone starts bugging out of their minds, and they become the kind of communal monster. They become the sci-fi version of a Twitter mob, basically, within themselves.
They do indeed, and as you pointed out in your terrific piece in the American interest. The way that this creature ends is so protracted. My God, it goes on forever trying to kill off poor Carrot James Arness.
Right. We always see these, I find them so disturbing, the best deaths in Game of Thrones and all of that. And this death that happens here, they try to manipulate Carrot Arness to go across these boards that they've put out and become electrocuted. And so he falls into this trap, and it's just so rudimentary. These boards, it's like you would throw this together with going to the Home Depot, getting some 2x4s and getting a camera and shooting this. And so they fry him, and the camera stays on this for so long. It feels like it plays out. It doesn't actually, for several minutes. And then he's dead, and one of the scientists is like, no, do some more. Basically reduce him to ash, so no one knows what happened here. It's like deleting your tweets, right?
Right.
So when you've been caught years after the fact, and it just shows that the extremes people will go to eradicate, to efface their own choices rather than owning their choices and being culpable. And this is a key idea, too. These are thinking people. These are the rarefied people of society. These are the scientists, and they are bugged out with panic themselves over their own actions and their own motivations. And you wonder at the end, hey, was Carrot Arness, what was he up to? Maybe he was just doing what he was supposed to do. And the humans are the ones who are, in fact, more problematic.
And a similar tale in 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still. How can anybody be upset with Michael Rennie? He seems like he wants to help everybody.
Absolute good guy going around and kind of goes on this travelogue. So what that film does really effectively is it's not science fiction bells and whistles, like, oh, look, rockets, red glare, all of that stuff. It's just very earthly. And I think that's some of the best horror, that's some of the best science fiction, where it's this day-in, day-out situation. Basically, it's like a tourist going around almost to the various spots that you'd hit up if you were coming through town for a long weekend. And people can't accept, and again, it's this additional precursor, they can't accept decency. And I think now we have a reason to really question decency. I almost feel like if you want to know if someone is up to no good, you can almost certainly tell by the fact that they've told you they are up to something truly honorable. Because I don't think people who are up to things that have a degree of honor to them are going to be concerned with informing you about that, broadcasting that on their Twitter platform or whatever. And so this is a very sort of quiet, good guy in this particular film who gets killed in the end only to be revived to tell us that it's only temporary, my revival. I will die again soon. But my goodness, you humans, what jackasses you are, and I mean that in a nice way, because you need to get better at being living things that interact with other living things, and off he goes. And the problem you feel, though, at the end of that film is just beginning. The close of the film is the start of something else. And that's a really effective way to bring a movie to its end.
And we'll talk about that more when we discuss Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But let's stop off first at 1954 and one of my all-time favorites, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
We have a blend here of ecological parable, right? Kind of like man's fall, human's fall from Eden. You have horror because you have one of the great monsters, the last of the great universal monsters after a bunch of years in between having any good ones. The best monster makeup maybe ever done outside of the first couple of Frankenstein pictures. And yet you have this sci-fi film. One of the fascinating things about the 1950s is the universal horrors are basically dead. That's all over. They're not coming back to life, save for this 11th hour visitation by the creature. And you have sci-fi taking over, and you have English horror at Hammer, which is much more gothic than the original universal run. So you have this melange with the creature, which is appropriate because he himself emerges from this watery do, right? The brackish water he's in that's captured this ship. And you have, again, man's vaulting ambition getting in his way. And you see that depicted in just very small details in the film. Someone carelessly flips their cigarette into the water, like, ah, screw you, water. You're here for us to use and to enjoy and do what we will with. Because really, we just live within our own echo chambers, and people are not thinking of the ramification. Meanwhile, the creature, who is portrayed as the baddie, again, it's all about perspective, has done nothing wrong. He's just going about his day, eating some abalone, whatever he does, right, looking for a female creature because he's lonely and it just sucks to be on your own all the time. And these people come in and start creating these problems. But again, they bring their problems. The problems with the people die in this film because they are jackasses to each other. It's not so much the creature, although he gets in a lick or two. But for the most part, it's the human bleep show rolling into town. And the creature's like, are you kidding me? You people can't even live with each other.
All he wanted was what was her name? Julie Adams? Was that the actress, I think, that played Kay?
Yes, and she died not that long ago.
That's right.
That's a wonderful scene. And you'll see it reprised in Jaws, the beginning of Jaws in 1975, that shot from like the bottom of the sea up towards the surface with the light coming through. Now, it's moonlight in Jaws and it's sunlight in Creature from the Black Lagoon, but that mimicking, that pantomime of his swimming and her swimming, and it's incredibly fluvially erotic in this strange way, too, because it is a Beauty and the Beast type of story, and as the film progresses, the humans become more beast-like, the creature becomes someone that you feel pity for. You have a resonant kind of feeling for him because you put yourself, he's the character, ironically, that we identify with. And you hear that expression that hell is other people. And I don't know if that's true because there are actually worse forms of hell on earth than other people. But there is an element of that. And the creature, at least, is in the kind of Eden removed from the rest of what people go through. So it poses this question of, do you want to be around some people and find a way to make that work and maybe be miserable? Or do you want to be on your own and try to piece things together, have growth and self-awareness, but also be lonely? So that in its own way is a very horrific notion of choice that I think some of us face.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to 1956 and a classic, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a film that, well, you watch that tonight, and it's every bit as relevant as it was 60-some years ago.
It is the most vatic, as in forward-thinking film, of the last 70, 75 years. It is terrifying, and if you had told me somebody with a time machine pulled a Doctor Who and went back and said, look, this is what the world is going to look like in 2019, now you can't be overt about this, but convey these themes metaphorically in this film, this is the film you would have created in response to that challenge. It is terrifying. I think the horror eclipses even the sci-fi nature of the film. But the reason it works so well, beyond how forward-thinking it is, it's so low-budgeted. If you look at it, it's almost comical, like, hey, does anybody on set have like a rumpus room we can go shoot in? And they do. They go to some guy's like basement. He's like, hey, here's my mini fridge from college. And here's the pool table. And they create horror out of this because it's so diurnal. It's just so what you wake up to every day. And I feel sometimes almost like this reverse polarity. And I've made this reference to you before, because I think we are sitting at the same table with, I recognize in you things that you recognize in me, where we almost have like this secret handshake that not a lot of people have anymore, like you're one of us. And what happens in the film is the baddies, the pod people, which I think a lot of people are right now in actuality, they have this siren call that they use to sound the alarm, basically. But I feel like good people now almost have like this kind of nudge, step into an alley with me, between you, me, and the lamppost. Are you one of the good ones? Are you one of the ones that remain? Are you one of the ones who doesn't live and die with social media and thinks that mob attacks is just a horrible thing? Do you still have integrity? Do you have character? please don't fall asleep on me. Stay with me type of thing. And, of course, there is that moment in the cave when he's with his girlfriend, our would-be hero, who we meet at the beginning after his ordeal. Funny the way this film is arranged.
Right.
Because it does not go in a linear fashion. And she wakes up and she has converted, and this guy, that final image of him on the highway, and the cars are, no one cares. No one cares about your problems, no matter how real they are, no matter how relevant they are for the rest of us, because we have to get home to have hootsies on the couch and just zone out into our own private nether worlds. And that is what this film is entirely about.
Well, and what's brilliant about it, and you don't need special effects for this, it's the scariest notion in the world that the people you think you know are not at all who you imagine them to be. And you can't help but watch this movie, and then the next day in every encounter with people, look at them and say, did they do that before? I don't remember. That's different. Oh, dear.
Exactly. Mm. And you know how when you go on YouTube and somebody has violated the copyright for some music, and the way they get around the violation of the copyright is they slow it down.
Right.
So you listen to something by the Beatles. And a lot of people won't notice there's anything off about it, but if you listen to Abbey Road a lot, you will notice that there's something off. It's like people who were just altered by a half measure rather than like a full person. And I would maintain that a lot of people right now are different than they were 3 or 4 years ago. And if you went back in time and met them, they would not blate on about the same would-be causes that they don't really care about. They would have more of an intact, actual, personalized identity. They are pod people who have mutated. So when he goes around the town and he meets these people that he lives amongst, and like, did she seem a little bit off to you? She didn't really use that expression before. It's so subtle. And the person who wrote this, right, is the same person, fascinating, who wrote the screenplay for, in the novel, for Out of the Past, the Robert Mitchum film.
Right.
So this was not some big, giant genre leap. It's being ensnared within this web of deceit. But the deceit is also from inside each of us. And they offer him a way out. The pod people, they say, look, you know, just swallow the pill, man, and be one of us. It's going to happen anyway. And he refuses to go along with it. And you have the sense at the end, finally. It is such a mercy, right, at the end of this film, when they're like, you know what, maybe we should believe this guy. You are like, oh, thank Christ. Like, your blood pressure goes back to something manageable again after that, because you do not want to see this film end with this guy totally cooked. Because in some ways, that means if you're one of the good people left, you are cooked as well, and you don't want that by extension.
Check out Colin's terrific piece in The American Interest. All his work, of course, at ColinFlemingLit.com. But we need to have part two of this discussion. This was great. Colin, thanks as always, and we'll see you again next week.
Okay, my friend.